This is the Meridian Podcast.
For the last 6 weeks, Iran has been rocked by protests, with thousands of people, from adults to school-aged children, taking to the streets in cities across the country, prompting a deadly crackdown by government forces. The protests were sparked by the death of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini after being detained by Iran's feared morality police for allegedly violating strict rules which require women to cover their hair with a headscarf or hijab. Amini's death caused an uproar amongst the women of Iran, with many taking to the streets, burning their hijabs and cutting their hair in protest. Men have also been joining the protests in solidarity, with protesters calling for more freedoms and some for total regime change. These protests seem to be amongst the most serious faced by the regime in a long time. But what actually comes next? Today, we speak to a young journalist and a professor from the University of Durham about how these events came to be and what the future may hold for the people of Iran. I'm Amelia Hardy.
I'm Michael Gorhan.
And welcome to the Meridian Podcast.
And welcome to the latest episode of the Meridian Podcast. Thank you very much for joining us. On today's episode, we're going to be talking about the protests in Iran, what the latest is there really, and what the trajectory of those protests are. And in this two-part interview, we're going to start off by speaking with Beau Roddis, who's a student journalist, and we're going to talk about what sparked the protests and what the trajectory of the protests are really. So it's really great to be joined by you, Beau.
Thank you. It's great to be on the show. Thank you for having me. It's an issue that I'm really passionate about, so really looking forward to delving into it with you.
Yeah, absolutely. Before we do begin, I always like to give people a chance to sort of introduce themselves. So if you wouldn't mind, would you mind just briefly explaining what sort of work you do with Empowered as an outlet, and also The Sun, if you wouldn't mind?
Yeah, of course. So with Empowered, which is a female-led digital media platform, and we sort of aim to unite female and non-binary journalists across the globe, and that's sort of our mission statement. So with Empowered, I'm the co-host and the editor of the Empowered Discussions podcast, which you can find on Spotify should you wish. And then I also write for them sort of on a regular basis as well, which is really nice because, you know, you get to kind of, you can pitch any ideas that you want, and you get to sort of claim any of the content that they put out on weekly call outs on Facebook, which is really nice. And you can kind of claim those, and it's really autonomous. You can do what you want with it. The aim is to kind of give a voice to everyone, and every opinion is, you know, welcome. And then with The Sun, I freelance for The Sun as a news reporter at the weekends in London, in their London Bridge office, which has been really exciting because I'm looking to kind of kickstart my career in journalism, and that's the first sort of official foot in the door. So yeah, that's been really exciting, and I've really enjoyed working with them, getting to know everyone, and being in an office environment as well, I think is really nice. You know, after the pandemic, it's nice to get back to seeing people face to face. So that's been really great as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely agree. And this is the Meridian, and we do love speaking with student journalists, so it's brilliant to have you on. So the first sort of question I think we should start with is, what exactly sparked this protest? Because it's been going on for around 6 weeks now. It's still continuing. But what, if you could just briefly explain, what actually happened to spark the protests?
Yeah, the death of Mahsa Amini in Iran, a 22-year-old girl who was stopped in the streets by the what they call the morality police for apparently not wearing her hijab correctly. And this death sort of coincided with the death of the Queen in Britain. So I think that this was a story that was huge, but maybe didn't receive the kind of coverage that it deserved at the time, because, you know, I mean, rightly, the Queen's death received a lot of coverage because that's, you know, a global event and a newsworthy story there. But I think that, as you say, you know, these protests have been going on for 6 weeks now. So this wasn't an inconsequential event either, but it was kind of overshadowed, I think, at the time. But yeah, Mahsa Amini was stopped by the morality police, who detained her, and they gave her what they call a re-education session, which is just an absolutely chilling thought. And that's what they kind of give women in Iran that they perceive have done something wrong. And as I said, it was that she wasn't wearing her hijab in the correct form, and the hijab has been mandatory in Iran since 1979, the time of the Iranian Revolution. So she then died in police custody, and a CT scan that was, I think, brought to light by The Guardian showed bruising on her head and a brain hemorrhage and damage to the skull, which obviously contributed to her death. And then the police released a duplicitous video suggesting that she died of perhaps a heart attack or epilepsy, something, you know, natural causes and non-related to being beaten, which is, I think, what sparked even more outrage, because, you know, then the CT scan was produced and it was clear that this was not sort of the cause of death. She didn't die of natural causes, and it was, in fact, you know, really quite a chilling, as I said, just a chilling kind of chain of events that, you know, somebody can perceive you to be doing something wrong. And, you know, it's kind of, I don't know, your word against theirs, I guess, because I, you know, in Iran, you probably wouldn't go out if you thought that you were wearing your headscarf wrong. You know, you probably wouldn't take that risk. So, you know, it's kind of an us and them sort of situation at the moment, I think.
Yeah, I think I quite like your description of chilling. I think I agree. It's almost Orwellian in a sense, isn't it? And I think, at least to me, it seems that this protest feels even bigger than just about Mahsa Amini. It feels about perhaps sort of decades of basically dissatisfaction with the regime. What do you sort of feel about that? What do you think the protesters' goals are?
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that this isn't just about her death. It's kind of years of pent-up frustration with the regime that people have. And so kind of her death has kind of ignited a massive movement. I'd kind of compare it, I guess, to the case of George Floyd, in that, you know, he wasn't the first black man to die under those circumstances. And the same is true of Mahsa Amini. So their deaths are kind of more of a touch paper that like ignites that, the frustration that's kind of already been building up and, you know, catalyzes, you know, in both cases, global protest. I think women in particular have a lot of built up frustrations with the regime in Iran, kind of curtailing their freedom. I've been following the hashtag My Stealthy Freedom for quite a while, and that's where women video themselves taking off their hijabs in public and then post it, obviously at great personal risk to themselves. But that's been going on for years now, and so that again just shows, you know, the kind of years of frustration. And we've seen, you know, protesters taking on that action of taking off their hijabs, burning their hijabs, you know, protesting in that way. But that is something that's actually been going on for quite a few years now. And I know that Iran also, during the pandemic, they'd kind of already been suffering in terms of like economic pressures. And so I think that young people in particular have felt those sort of economic frustrations and are kind of reacting to that as well. And hardworking people feel that, you know, the impact of sanctions in a way that elites never do. And so I think that that again has kind of sparked the protests. And so it's not necessarily about just the death of one woman, but her death is definitely kind of acted as sort of a touch paper, as I said, for pent up frustrations with the regime that I think has been curtailing people's political and economic freedom for years. And I think that's kind of what's at the forefront of the protests, in terms of the main goals of the protests, that, you know, they want that political and economic freedom first and foremost. And that's kind of what it's about, really.
Yeah. So then, on the topic of sort of whether protesters want sort of reform or revolution, does it appear that they want revolution? Do they want do they want regime change? Or do you think perhaps it's just about getting some more freedoms, particularly for women? Or is it broader than that, and it's, like I say, this sort of desire for regime change?
I think a bit of both. You know, I think they would like to see the regime toppled, I think, probably. And, you know, some sort of a breath of fresh air come in, a new regime, maybe a new form of governance that enacts sort of those sort of reforms that allow the more political and economic freedoms and, you know, allow women's rights to flourish. So, yeah, I think it's kind of a bit of both and maybe broader than both as well, in that, that, you know, it's not necessarily just that they want a regime change, because a regime change, another regime could come in and just do more of the same. And then that achieves nothing. So I think it's kind of, they want fresh new perspectives, new people in power, but also those people to deliver the reforms as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's quite interesting, isn't it? Because, of course, even if there isn't a sort of revolution, and even if they don't topple the regime, there's been a sort of discussion about whether, in some sense, there still has been a sort of revolution of ideas, in that women have been sort of liberated and that now other women have burned their hijabs in the street, that they've sort of broken down a wall that hadn't previously been broken down, and that it's very difficult to come back from that. How do you sort of feel about that sort of way of looking at it? Do you think that, although perhaps even if regime change doesn't happen, that it's still been a revolution of sorts, if that sort of makes sense?
No, absolutely. And I do think that, and I think especially maybe as well, seeing the global response, you know, we've had protests here in the UK, in Germany, in Berlin. And, you know, I think that if you're kind of on the inside looking out and you see that other women are standing up for what you're protesting and saying that they agree with you, that this isn't correct, then, you know, it's going to be very hard to kind of put that genie back in the bottle, as it were. Kind of, you know, you're not going to be able to repress them anymore, because they've seen that, you know, other women are standing up alongside them, fighting for the same cause, again, you know, holding up signs that kind of criticize the Iranian government. And, you know, it's hard to come back from that, I think, when you've seen that. So yeah, I think it probably is sort of a liberation, and maybe a change in the thoughts, in the feelings of women in Iran as well.
Yeah, and you mentioned there how sort of Western governments have responded, and people in the West have responded in support, really. Have there been any specific methods that like Western countries have taken to try and kind of condemn what's been going on in Iran that have sort of stood out to you?
I mean, the US has kind of, you know, said that they support the women of Iran. And I think the Iranian government has been particularly hostile about that, and blamed the US and Israel, actually, as well, which obviously isn't in the West. But they've blamed them as well for kind of catalyzing the protests. And I think I have a quote here that says that Iran's leaders said, you know, don't sell your honor to America and don't slap the security forces who are defending you in the face. And so they definitely do have quite a strong opinion towards the fact that America has maybe, well, they think that America has been sort of duplicitous in its actions. There are sort of conversations going on at the moment between Iran and the US in regards to restoring the international nuclear agreement. And I think Iran is kind of thinking that the US could now use what's happening in Iran now as like leverage to exert maybe political and psychological pressure on Iran to obtain concessions in the negotiations. And so they've said they won't make any concessions. So they definitely do see what's happening in their country as a threat. And I think they also see like the Western response as a threat, because, you know, they feel that the US might use it to kind of gain concessions. And I think, again, kind of what I said before about if other countries are also protesting alongside the women of Iran, they'll kind of see that and know that their position is becoming more untenable, really.
Definitely, definitely. And of course, it's not the first time that there's been protests in Iran. There's been protests sort of throughout the last decade. And of course, as we talked about before, in the Iranian Revolution, millions of people sort of took to the streets and protested, and the regime fell. Now, these protests aren't getting sort of the same amount of numbers. They're definitely getting just as much international recognition, no doubt about that. And hundreds of thousands of people are taken to the streets. But what would have to change from the protest, what would have to change from sort of the current situation for this protest to achieve anything, whether that be, I think, quite a lofty expectation would be revolution, but even just reform? Are these protests big enough, and how really, how can they achieve reform? Because it doesn't seem to have worked yet.
Yeah, I would say that it doesn't seem to have worked yet. And, you know, Iran's kind of government and their security forces have said that they're cracking down on protests, and we've seen kind of protesters being attacked by those security forces as well. I think we had a shooting at students at a girls' school, so it's definitely, you know, not achieving the, you know, if anything, it's achieving the opposite of what they intended at this point. I think probably more international pressure would help. You know, we're seeing kind of the protests across Berlin, the US, etc. But I think if Western governments could like unite and you know, impose sanctions or kind of impress upon them the seriousness of the need to reform. But I do think that, you know, it's kind of, it is probably a question of regime change, because, you know, I don't think the current regime really wants to engage with that sort of dialogue. So it is probably, as we've kind of discussed before, a combination of regime change and reform that's needed, and maybe some external pressure would help that a little bit. You know, I think the media coverage has definitely intensified since, you know, I said it was kind of subdued whilst the death of the Queen was going on, but I don't think it's intensified to kind of quite the level of, you know, when I mentioned George Floyd earlier, there's not kind of the global outcry yet that I think is necessary to kind of catalyze that change. It's happening, but I think it needs to be bigger and on sort of a more global stage to kind of affect that change.
Yeah, interesting, isn't it? I mean, during the George Floyd thing, we saw the sort of blackout screens. Now, whether you agree or not, yeah, with sort of social media activism, it definitely demonstrated that practically everyone, at least in our circles and my circle, was engaging with that. But perhaps one of the things that has prevented that happening might be the fact that the government have sort of imposed these internet blackouts. So there's actually a lot of information that isn't getting out, and a lot of the clips that are getting out of Iran aren't. I mean, we're getting lots of information, but there's still plenty of things that aren't getting out of Iran. But just from your sort of perspective, looking at the protests, does it feel to you like a sort of a leaderless movement? How would you sort of characterize what you've seen on social media? Does it feel more bottom up or top down from your sort of perspective?
I think from what I've observed, it seems more bottom up to me. I couldn't identify a leader or even like a leading organisation. I mentioned My Stealthy Freedom, which has seen sort of an increase in its activities. But, you know, that's been going on sort of in the background for a couple of years now. In terms of, you know, the protests, I can't really think of, you know, specific leading organization or specific leading individuals who are really kind of, you know, driving these protests. And I think maybe that's something, again, that's needed. You know, we spoke about maybe a bit more international pressure, maybe a more streamlined, consolidated movement, because to me, it does feel, from what I've seen anyway, that it does feel more bottom up, more sort of, I guess, kind of emotional and reactional, just in the sense that it's not as, you know, as an organized collective movement. It's kind of just all come out of nowhere a little bit, I think, and with with direction, but kind of less direction than it might have if there was sort of a clear leader, which I think is a shame, because, you know, as you said, we saw the black screens being posted when George Floyd died. And as you said, whether you agree with that or not, I didn't know anyone that didn't know what happened to George Floyd, who he was, everything like that, and what was kind of coming out of his death. Whereas I have friends that haven't heard about this story. And so I think that is, you know, I mean, partly on them because it is, you know, a big story, but it's just not getting quite as much attention. And I think maybe a more streamlined movement would make that possible as well.
Yeah, no, it's a great point, and we could probably do a whole other episode talking about why certain stories filter through and why certain stories don't filter through into the sort of social media sphere, and that is a fascinating topic. But a sort of last question now, I don't want to keep you for too long. I just want to talk about the sort of the future of these protests. Now, obviously, we're 6 weeks in, not much has changed. What do you think is the likely legacy of these protests?
I think it's quite hard to say at this point, because of sort of the Iranian government have literally said, we are going to crack down and we don't want you to protest anymore. So I think future protests would come at a great personal risk. So it's quite hard, I think, to say whether they will carry on with the same momentum as they would, you know, after we've seen these attacks and shootings as well by the security guards in Iran. You know, whether people are still willing to put themselves in that position, or, you know, whether that instills the fear that I guess they're hoping that it instills into people to curtail the protests. So I think we're in sort of a transitional phase of it right now where it's quite hard to predict where it's going to go. But I think there are definite lessons that can be learned from it. And I think kind of everything we've spoken about today, and just in terms of kind of where the protests will go from here, I think it's all up in the air right now. It really depends on how serious the government is about cracking down, and then how serious the protesters are about keeping going as well.
Yeah, no, a smart answer. It is very difficult to sort of project what's going to happen. Unfortunately, we're having a sort of half and half episode today, so I'm going to have to end our conversation here, which is a shame. And there's so much more I'd like to ask you, but Bo, thank you very much for joining me on the Meridian podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure, and good luck with the rest of it as well.
Of the podcast, we are joined by Dr. Marzia Kuhi, who is an assistant professor in politics and international relations of the Middle East at the University of Durham. Thank you so much for being here today. It's really lovely to have you. Would you like to introduce yourself and tell your listeners a bit about your work?
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me. Well, you explained that my broader area of research is politics and international relations of the Middle East. I'm mostly focused on Iran's political developments, especially its foreign policy, and on the one hand, and with regards to domestic politics, issues regarding to women's movements and women's rights.
So very knowledgeable in the area of Iran, which sort of leads into the first question, actually, which I'd like to ask, is that I think it's important to view the current protests in sort of a larger context. Mm-hmm. Obviously, with the Iranian Revolution in 1979, a lot changed in Iran. I was wondering, for the benefit of our listeners, because, of course, you've got so much knowledge about this, if you could sort of paint a picture of what life was like for women in particular before the Iranian Revolution. Under the Shah in the 60s and 70s, and how that changed, and how that's changed over the last sort of four decades.
Okay, so obviously my personal experience is limited because I was a little kid at the time, but from my studies, there has been some developments after the revolution, and there have been some rights that have been taken away from women after the revolution. That is what I've argued in my 2014 paper, which is called Iranian Women, One Step Forward, Two Steps Back. So before the revolution, Iranian women didn't have voting rights for all, like, all important elections and so on. I mean, there wasn't presidential elections, but there was were parliamentary elections. Also, but on the other hand, they were free to, in the second Pahlavi era. In the first Pahlavi era, he treated women as symbols of, and how it is, how they dress as a symbol of modernization, okay? So he ordered, the first Pahlavi ordered a ban of hijab, which faced complete, a lot of protests, but like it was a widespread a law which was enforced sometimes even by coercion. The second Pahlavi, he left it to the people. So women were free to choose their attire. Lots of social freedom. So for example, people were not banned from drinking. If they were not doing it, it was because of their own moral obligations or religious thoughts. And also with regards to women's legal right, it was much wider. It was more in the interest of women rather than just in the interest of men. After the revolution, gradually, although during the revolution it was promised that hijab wouldn't be compulsory, or women were encouraged by the supreme leader Khomeini at the time to take a strong political involvement, social involvement. After the revolution, gradually, after just a few months, hijab became compulsory. It was initially in the organizations and institutions, and then it became compulsory everywhere. A lot of curbing happened on women's legal rights, for example, especially with regards to family law. And what else? One thing which happened, again, which was a positive, was increased involvement of women in higher education after the revolution. Before the revolution, many religious families wouldn't allow their daughters to go. I mean, I had classmates who stopped, before the revolution, after primary school, and resumed their education after after the revolution, because their families agreed that, okay, now the society is Islamic, it is okay for girls to continue their education. So like we were sitting in a class where we had some students older than us because they had to stop before the revolution. Also the university entrance increased a lot. So currently, annually, girls entering the university is around 60%, sometimes 63%, sometimes, but it's around 60%, while for boys it is less. So there is a lot of good things going on, but that even those positives were being curbed in recent years. So for example, some of the subjects were had a cap on accepting women, and so they would say that this is more a masculine job, and there is no point in masculine market. There is no point in accepting women in these areas.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, do you think then? Because it sounds like it's quite complex. Like you said, it's not just a case of the Iranian revolution happening and things getting worse, which is, I think, at least for people that aren't well-versed in sort of the history and politics of Iran may view it that way. But do you think there is a sense with the current protests of nostalgia, a sense of nostalgia for the 60s and 70s? And do you think that might be a bit misplaced, perhaps?
I think it is misplaced for several reasons. Not maybe for women. Women have more rights to have such nostalgia. But generally speaking, like the repression. Minus this last couple of years, the repression on social on political freedom, on political activities, and so on. Were not that much different during the recent years, the most latest years of the Shah. Like they were the same as now, that there are intelligence services cracking down on people who are criticizing and like putting them in prison. This was the same. This was the case during the Pahlavi as well. So it that wasn't different. There were the economy was growing, and there were considerable developments. Obviously, because the Shah was not fighting several other world powers, that is the major reason. However, the gap between the poor and the rich was increasing, and that was one of the reasons that the revolution happened. The other issue was the other issue which facilitated the revolution was, like, basically the Shah or the ruler, the government, not listening to the people. So he was very swiftly going through a westernization process in the name of modernization, but it was very westernized, and people didn't like it. A massive proportion of people felt that it is against or their cultural religious values have been manipulated and ignored. Okay, during the Islamic Republic, especially in recent years, again the state is not, the government is not listening when people are saying enough is enough. We want to have proper relations with the world. We want to have we want our economy to develop. We are fed up with being enforced religious values. Not that we are against religious values. Some people are, some people are not. But even like people like me who are more religious are fed up with religion being instrumentalized by politics. And again, the government doesn't listen. So in some areas, they were very similar. And the way they treated people, there are many similarities. So obviously people who have nostalgia are younger generations who can't remember. And this younger generation, interestingly, are a massive proportion of population. So like more than 30% of the population are under 40 years old. So they were not even born during the Shah, so they cannot remember it. Because everybody is fed up with the present situation, either economically, politically, socially, it is the memory. You tend to remember the positives of the past, not the pains of the past. So even the older generations, they mostly remember, oh, during the Shah, we were like this, we were like that. We could easily go across the world. Our passport were so valuable. However, for those who were activists, who were looking for political freedom, that the life wasn't as sweet as people imagine.
So looking at these protests, there seem to be more to it than the death of Mahsa Amini? Obviously, that was sort of a spark that led to the wide unrest and obviously women removing their hijabs, cutting their hair in solidarity. But is it kind of being spurred on by the decades of sort of hardline rule and repression and less freedoms than people would have wanted?
Yeah, exactly. So people in various ways over the decades have shown that they are not happy with the direction that the system is going, and they tend to use all democratic avenues possible for them to show this disinterest and to show this regret of the directions, either in foreign policy, in economy, and in their social life. And so one significant case was the case of presidency of Khatami, where people with a high proportion, the turnout was massive, and people elected somebody that the system didn't want to, but people wanted him because he was promising reforms. And he tried, but semi-quasi states and many other organizations prevented him. With the election of Rouhani, people showed that they don't want the more conservative candidates. They want someone who is more moderate. And although Rouhani was not as moderate as Khatami, still there was a promise of change. So people showed it with their votes. When Ahmadinejad was elected for the second round with the rigged elections, there was this green movement, and that was cracked down. So like it is years after years that people are using any peaceful, dialectic, and more constructive ways to show that they don't agree with what is going on with the system. If we look 2 years ago, I mean the significant uprisings were in 2009 with the rigged election. Then it was 2 years ago with the rise of petrol prices, which was massive disruptions. And then this case, so it was building up. It was political dissatisfaction, and then it is economy, and then it is like people. Another way that people try to show that they are not happy with what is going on is that when in this round of presidential elections, many candidates were vetted out, and only the ones which were ensured that they wouldn't have enough votes were allowed to take in competition with Raisi. People simply didn't turn out for the ballots, or when they turned out, the number of blank votes were much higher than the number of Raisi's votes. So people have shown that they don't like the system's candidates. They don't like the way it is going, and they were enforced to accept these people, someone like Raisi and his team at the governance. Okay, and then Raisi and his governance not being able to revive or not being able to renegotiate JCPOA. So still the economic sanctions are in their place. Not being able to tackle the deeply rooted corruption and many problems that the country have, started to project the problems to something else. Like started to banging on the necessity of the hijab. And that was not just saying that you have to have the hijab. Every day there was something about how we can enforce hijab in public sphere. So restaurants and coffee shops were being closed down for giving services to women who didn't have the confirmed attire, the preferred attire. The organizations were coming out, everybody was giving ideas of how they are going to prevent services, ban services to women who don't have proper hijab. And like the more moderate political elites were kept saying that this is not the right way to do it. And women like me who have hijab, who do not have problem with hijab, they have problem with its compulsion. And we started talking, we were saying like you can't force this, this is curbing on people's essential rights. And nobody was listening. a few weeks before Mahsa's case, there was an argument between a woman who have a pro-government woman with like top head to toe cover hijab, with a woman who another lady who didn't have proper hijab, as they put it, in the bus. And it resulted that the brawl in the bus resulted in the public kicking out the pro-government woman out of the bus. And this was this brawl was the result of the atmosphere that the government was cooking with regards to the hijab. But what happened was the lady with less hijab, with inappropriate hijab, according to them, was arrested, was tortured. She was brought to the TV with the bruises on her face to confess that she made a mistake and she shouldn't do that. And to be honest, it was that time that I was waiting. I was expecting people to do something, because it was gobsmacking, really, like the brutality, and then bringing that brutality to public sphere, showing it clearly in the state TV. It was really mind-blowing. But nothing happened that time, apart from like more moderate political elites, university students, university activists giving statements that we do not agree with this way and stop doing that. And then Mahsa happened. So it was building up both with regard to everything else which is going on in the country, political, economic, and social issues, but also with regards to the issue of hijab itself. It was building up to this point, and this was the point of explosion.
Yeah, so do you think then that, obviously, we mentioned before, there's been lots of protests in Iran over the last decade. You mentioned just there was one in 2009. There was one in 2019 as well over fuel prices. Well, that's what sparked it. What sort of makes these protests different?
Okay, so first of all, the root of this one, this is the social aspect of people's living. So people are saying, okay, you are not fixing the political atmosphere. It is going more and more conservative. The economy is in ruins. And then you poke your fingers everywhere in our private and social life. So that was something. So the root of this one, or the agitator for this one, was a social reason. What makes it also different is that the other times it was like in a few cities or in few areas, and with like particular groups of people, either, for example, especially the 2019, it wasn't that none of these uprisings, none of these unrests were as inclusive and as this one. So this one, you see people going into streets in rich areas, well-off streets, middle classes, poor areas. They've gone to, they have taken to streets at universities, but also like lower educated areas of the city, deprived areas. In large cities, they've taken to streets in large cities, but also in very small areas, in very small rural areas of the country. So it is more widespread. Also, in other years, with the crackdown, it would die down. So after 1 week, 2 weeks, 2 weeks, it has never gone beyond a few weeks. But now we are around the 50 days, the 50th days of these unrest. And there is no sign of it dying down, even though the crackdown has been much heavier. The number of people killed is not as high as the 2019, because then they were using live rounds. this time the use of live rounds is limited. They are using rubber bullets, but still the crackdown is massive. The number of arrests is gone to thousands. I've read a number a few days ago, and it was over 12,000, stated by official media. It wasn't like rumor, it is official media statement that it has been over 12,000 people. And many other people have been incarcerated just unofficially. So that is not taking into account this number. However, despite all these crackdowns, it hasn't died down. And it is inclusive in that people are from all walks of life are getting involved. So it is not only like people who have problems with hijab or are less religious or less well off. It covers a massive proportion of the population.
So, as you mentioned, with how sort of widespread and inclusive these protests are and how long that they've gone on for, what is the sort of realistic chance of any policy or even regime change within Iran as a result of these protests?
Well, to be honest, I'm not that sure. I was hoping that, and many political elites were pushing for that, but it didn't happen. That the government gives in a couple of areas to people, and then a dialogue starts. So people start having a dialogue, telling their demands, and then a sort of bargaining and negotiation would start with the civil society, with public, and everything. That didn't happen. It is either massive crackdown or gaslighting. That is not happening. This is just lie. This is external interference. These are like separatists. These are these. So lots of branding and gaslighting is going on without accepting the responsibilities for some of the wrongdoings which has happened. So that on the part of government, I see no, where me and many other people hoped for some giving in, there is no such thing. It is going more and more strict. And every time, it is interesting that every time there is a couple of days of quiet, someone from official organizations comes out and says something which ignites the unrest again, as if they are trying to, I don't know, self-sabotage. It looks like self-sabotage. I don't know why they cannot see how dangerous is the situation. So that is from any hope from the government, it's perished. With regards to revolution, well, revolution needs some prospects. So A widely accepted leader, some sort of ideology or outlook, direction, where we are going towards. And this is missing. Okay, so a large population, a lot of people, we can say a majority of people want change. They want, but some of them, even those who are in the street, are saying if it is possible without regime change, we'll go with the regime change. We've had one revolution, we are still paying the price. It is not that because they love the Islamic Republic, it's just they are tired of what happens during and after the revolutions. Other people, what they want is, in many ways, are different. So there is a wide range of ideas, there is wide spectrum of ideas. But none of these ideas have a proper ideology behind it, have a proper outlook forward it, and not a widely accepted leader.
Yeah, fascinating. Yeah, so you said that there's not, it's perhaps, it's leaderless, and perhaps, like you said, it's almost directionless in the sense that there's not a clear goal, then do you think there is a genuine threat to the rule of the clerics and the rule of Khomeini? Like, is there a genuine threat there?
I think there is a genuine threat, but that genuine threat is, like, whether it is from inside or whether it is because of every other thing which is going on in the region, with the international community. The situation is really dire. It is really bad from what I see. But I'm not sure which one is more dangerous. Like, is it more dangerous for everybody if the unrest goes on? If the government doesn't give in and then it goes militaristic? So, because there is evidence that some jihadi groups try to infiltrate, like the border areas. There is evidence of that. Some people are fed up, so the level of violence is increasing. For example, a few days ago, a group of these people in the street took one of these plain-clothed security guys. They tortured him and they killed him. I mean, he consequently died. So the level of violence, as the government increases, people are getting more agitated, and the level of violence is increasing from the side of the people as well. And that can lead to a lot of other problems, maybe civil war, maybe, I'm not sure. It is so complicated that I don't see what is next. But it is definitely a very dangerous situation.
Yeah, absolutely. Sort of one more question to kind of round everything off. Obviously, it's a very kind of, it's hard to tell what could possibly come next, even day to day. But for somebody looking back on this period in sort of 5 years' time, what do you think the likely legacy of these protests will be?
So the likely legacy would obviously depends on what comes next. But also it is a learning curve. So people learn that what they've done, what they could do, what they've done which was wrong, what they could avoid or they should avoid. So, like, there is talks that all right, we are not going to sank to make this political activist or that political activist so big that nobody can criticize them, because that would contribute to another authoritarian regime. So that is something that many people have learned. People are coming up with innovative ideas. I mean, like, especially at universities, university lecture, with innovative ideas to avoid violence, but still show their resistance. I was going to write a paper on this, that there is a wide range of artworks which is coming out every day, which symbolizes people's demand and people's resistance. And they are so good and the high quality, but it is in itself is a sort of resistance in itself. So still people are trying to find ways which are constructive, which are civilized and peaceful as much as it is possible, avoiding violence, but establishing some level of change, at least if not regime change totally. So that is a huge wealth of learning that people are going through.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Unfortunately, we haven't got much more time, so we're going to have to round off there. I'm sure we could go on for another half an hour easily. We have so much to ask you. But Dr. Marzia Kuhi, thank you very much for joining us on the Meridian podcast.
Thank you for inviting me.
No problem.
Thanks. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Meridian Podcast. We hope you enjoyed listening to it as much as we enjoyed creating it. If you liked what you heard, why not subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts so our latest episode lands in your feed. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram and TikTok too, at The Meridian Podcast. And if you've got an idea for an episode or would like to appear, send us an email at meridianpodcast@gmail.com. This episode was presented and edited by Michael Gorham and Amelia Hardy. The theme music is Impending Uncertainty by Gavin Luke and Solar Flare, licensed by Creative Commons. Until next time, thanks for listening.